This edition of Culture was first broadcast on the 23rd of January 2012 on Monocle 24. Culture on Monocle 24, brought to you by Mercedes-Benz. Hello and welcome to the 15th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. In this show, we make for the snow-decorated cinemas of Park City, Utah, to see what's playing to packed houses and which deals are going down at the 28th Sundance Film Festival.
Yeah, condos and hotel rooms are definitely hotspots for deals, but it's just not quite the feeding frenzy that it used to be. It's a little more organized now than it used to be.
We'll be talking about Good Vibrations and our new favorite record shop in Zurich. We get a sporty 1 minute of sound at the Australian Open Tennis, and you'll be treated to a magical report from Phnom Penh, conjuring Cambodia's golden age of film.
Kids coming to see a film in the morning, and after they came back in the afternoon, I say, oh, sorry, it's the same film. They say, yeah, we know, but we want to see it again.
And if that weren't enough, we'll be learning how Belgium's public broadcasters are having communication problems.
The official tasks that the broadcasters get is specifically to aim at their own community, but also to reinforce the culture of the own community. And there's actually no reference to the Belgian context, to the federal level.
That's all in Culture here on Monocle 24 over the next hour. Stay tuned. Now, before we hear what's been making waves at the Sundance Film Festival, let's hear a little tune for my album of the week, Blacklight by Diagrams. And this is the title track.
Stars in the neon bars in the city's beat. All the way up, try to get stuck.
And that was Black Light from the album Black Light by Diagrams. More from that album of the week later. This is Culture on Monocle 24. Now this year, with a little reluctance, the Culture Show left its skis in the garage and called up some of its friends way out west to get a feel for what was hot, what was cool, what was bought and what was sold at this year's 28th Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. Our first stop was with Colin Brown, a former editor of Screen International, who takes the long view of Sundance and this year's big change, funding films by asking your fans for finance.
It started when I was first there. It was very much off the global radar, in fact. It was very American-centric, and it was a launch pad for talents who often sort of scratched incredibly meager budgets and made, very personal films for very limited audiences. This was the beginning of the independent film movement in America. Now, over the years, those films started, and it's really traced back to, I think, Sex, Lies, and Videotape and mm-hmm. Reservoir Dogs, two films that showed that there was, you could also make money. So the distributors all piled in, not only the American distributors, but also, distributors from around the world. And in fact, that changed the nature of Sundance. So many of the filmmakers and actors associated with those early films are now actually the establishment. I mean, almost, whether it's Brad Pitt or Bryan Singer or any of these, names which, associated with Hollywood blockbusters now, they all got their beginnings at films that were shown at Sundance. And so in some ways, it became a victim of its own success. And Sundance became the establishment. And everyone said that Sundance, became Hollywood. I would argue that Hollywood became Sundance. A lot of the films recently that arrived at Sundance already had global distribution in place, partly because those Hollywood studios set up art house divisions, many of whose releases were in fact Sundance films. So so it's not just the Miramax of its day was there, but also Fox set up for Fox Searchlight. We had Sony Classics. So we had art house divisions of major conglomerates buying these films, frankly inflating their budgets and also changing the perceptions. Suddenly these films had to have stars. Ironically enough, to be able to work overseas. And Sundance sort of got in the grip of that. I think, there was a while when it chose its own films, I think, based on their star power. Now everything's come full circle. And what's interesting is that where Sundance once was, which was to make films on, you know, on a sort of bootstrapped, you know, personal level, raising money from your dentist and going, you know, sort of hand to mouth and scraping everything together for family and friends. Well, that's now come full circle. We're now seeing that movement come up again, but it's being done through technology. It's being done through the web. So we're getting these donation sites.
To link to that, last year I was at Sundance making a documentary for Monocle about it, and one commentator said, you know, gone are the days when Harvey Weinstein used to rock up, or used to wait till the end of a movie and then, you know, open his big sort of suitcase of cash. And now I guess it's happening, but in increments, and it's happening via technology and websites, but especially set up to do this. So I wanted to ask you about the crowdsourcing model. I mean, how old's the idea of it?
Well, the idea... If you ask Kickstarter, they'll tell you that the idea is as old as patronage.
Mm-hmm.
That it's a way, you know, that goes back to, you know, I don't know, the Medicis.
Or right.
That, you know, although I think there's a big difference. I mean, they've used the patronage, and they're only 2 years old, by the way. You know, so all of this is relatively new. Even though there's about 250 crowdfunding sites, you know, around the world covering all sorts of niches, and not just film, obviously, but there is a big difference from the patronage. And the patronage sort of implies very rich people, you know, sort of playing this, you know, higher role and coming down and saying, yes, we'll bless your film and we'll give you money. What's interesting about this is it's in reverse. I think it's you know, it's family and friends and part, you know, strangers. I mean, I think there's a lot of stranger dollars that are going into these projects for very small amounts. I mean, I think the typical average amount that's going into these films that have been made through Kickstarter and Indiegogo is no more than $25. So if you find a way to amass lots of $25, you can, you know, get up to the six figures, which seems to be the current cap.
Yeah.
It won't be long before there's a $1 million film. Filmmakers are now going to have to build their own audience, just like authors do. And, you know, and once they do that, you know, they can set up a great system for, you know, for collecting money, and they can keep going back to the well, because you know, they now have the list.
And because the donations, I suppose, are very small as well.
Correct.
When you hear the headlines from Sundance, you don't hear about sequels. You don't hear about films that are based on board games. I presume it still, for you, has a sense of the indie aesthetic and people playing with ideas rather than simply raking in cash.
Absolutely, and,
yeah.
And the core Sundance film remains, I think, you know, very personal. You know, touching on stories that wouldn't normally be told. It tries to tell them in unusual styles. And Sundance is, I think, you know, deliberately each year they try to look for what's different from, you know, so that, you know, they make sure that there's a diversity of subjects, a diversity of stories, geographies, people, all those things, and, you know, much more so than the marketplace itself. The moment they do so, of course, it legitimizes those. And then, of course, a year or two later, you see lots of those films. So then their challenge is to then find the next frontier. You know, the essential paradox of the film industry is this. You know, people like to be surprised. That's what does well. And yet you cannot get surprise or something different funded. And I think that's always been the big dilemma. You pitch an idea, and they say, well, what's it like? Well, it's actually, it's Sex Lies meets Avatar. Oh, that sounds great. But actually what people want to go and see is the thing that they've never seen before. They wanted to see Sex Lies because it was different, and they wanted to see Avatar because it was different. So that's always been the funding dilemma that the film industry has always faced, which is it knows that people want to see something different. That's what you pay to see in a theater. You want to be surprised, but you can't finance surprise.
That was Colin Brown, former editor of Screen International. Next up, we roused the film editor of Variety from his hotel bed in Park City to ask him about deals, how to keep tabs on all the festival gossip, and whether or not you should invest in buzz. But first, let's have another song, On and On by Justice. I think you'll find they're French. This is from their new remixes release.
Those sweet babies.
That was On and On, not Onion, by Justice. And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. In this show, we make for the snow-decorated cinemas of Park City, Utah, to see what's playing to packed houses and which deals are going down at the 28th Sundance Film Festival. This is Variety's film editor, Josh Dickey.
We're keeping tabs on a bunch of deals. The movies that have shown here already have already gotten a lot of interest from buyers. I wouldn't say that this has so far been quite as busy a market as last year has, but the movies that we've seen have gotten a lot of interest. In particular, Beasts of the Southern Wild, which is sort of a magical realism, very unusual film that tells the story of Hush Puppy, a young girl who's living in a post-Katrina New Orleans. That's a very imaginative, very unusual sort of world. Lots and lots of buyers there. We're tracking that very closely. And then, some of the premieres that we've seen as well have also gotten interest. And we haven't had a lot of deals get done yet, but that's sort of normal for the festival. We'll mm-hmm. see the first few days being actually kind of slow, and then things will start to pop once everybody gets a chance to see all the movies they are interested in. And start making offers. So we expect the next, 2-3 days, a lot of buying activity from sort of the usual suspects, you know, the Weinstein Company, Sony Pictures Classics, Fox mm-hmm. Searchlight, Focus, so on and so forth.
And how are these deals done? When enough people go and see them? I mean, are they done in hotel rooms? Are they done sort of outside the movie theaters themselves, or are they done in the bars and restaurants on Main Street in Park City?
Listen, if I knew exactly where these deals were being done, I'd be planning listening devices all over town. I think the sort of days of the overnight, in middle of the night, at post-screening bidding wars are over. It's a little bit more genteel than it used to be in that everybody gets a chance to see the movies that they want to see, and then everybody waits for the offers to come in, and then the negotiating begins. Yeah, condos and hotel rooms are definitely hot spots for deals. but it's just not quite the it's not quite the feeding frenzy that it used to be. It's a little more organized now than it used to be.
And is that because people are a little bit maybe cash poor and therefore a little bit more conservative and want to see what audiences make of these films rather than using their own sort of gut instinct, or is it have people just got a little bit more well mannered generally?
Yeah, no, I think in these days of social media, there's certainly a lot more that people can sort of study in terms of buzz and what others are saying about the movies. Reviewers from all the outlets practically in the world are here, frantically reviewing movies the day after they're or the day that they're unspooled. But it's not as though as though folks are worried that something's going to get away from them. I mean, if a buyer wants to make an offer on a movie, they're going to be heard out.
Yeah. Having a look at Variety online and what you've been writing about, Compliance, a horror movie, Arbitrage, which is a sort of smart Wall Street or critique of Wall Street. Has anything else sort of piqued your interest? Would you go as far as tipping anything to be big this year, Josh?
Well, the movie everybody's talking about is Beasts of the Southern Wild. Mm-hmm. That is, so far, everybody's favorite. Compliance got a lot of buzz, and it's got buyers circling for sure, and we'll see a deal get made on that one, I think, in pretty short order. You know, Lay the Favorite, the Bruce Willis gambling movie last night, was a big one. And the other night, although I won't say too much about the movie, Red Lights was a big film here, which is the Robert De Niro, Sigourney Weaver, Elizabeth Olsen sort of psychological thriller. Didn't play that well, but I think it'll probably also get some commercial appeal and interest. But without question, I mean, the movie that everybody right now is talking about and that we're tracking most closely is Beasts of the Southern Wild.
That was Variety's film editor, Josh Dickey. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're back after this.
Avant-garde.
I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much of other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary
to see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
The February issue of Monocle has a warm glow as we look at how charm adds longevity to brands, makes offices great places to work, and keeps people returning to the same restaurants year after year. But there's more.
In the design section, we take a closer look at charm and profile 10 companies around the world that are nailing it. We also kick back on the beach in New Zealand in Herbst Architect's latest creation.
Plus, there's our Japan travel survey, a visit to a jail turned craft school in Charleston, a neighbourhood to call home in Stockholm, and a rugged tale from Tehran. The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Now, documentaries were also hot this year at the 28th Sundance Film Festival, and none warmer than HBO's film about performance artist Marina Abramović, The Artist is Present. Nancy Abraham, Senior VP of Documentaries and Head of Programming at HBO, shared some of her very busy day with us. For HBO, has it been more of a marketplace to sell stuff or to acquire stuff, or do you never really know until you turn up and see the other documentaries on offer?
Yeah, we never really know until we get here and sort of see what's around and what's happening. There's always so much to see between the international and the domestic documentaries. But it is a great platform, not so much for selling, but for the docs that we're involved with, that we've produced, it's a great platform for launching them. I mean, there's no other place like Sundance for getting attention and recognition for documentaries. So that's a big part of it, too.
And is that about sort of critical acclaim and getting an internet buzz and a critical buzz going on about things? Or is it about getting distribution deals?
It's more about, I would say, the critical acclaim and the buzz and the talking about the films and recognition for them, and than it is about distribution per se, because obviously these films are going to be on HBO, so to a certain extent they have their distribution already set.
People have been talking a lot about the Marina Abramović film, which is on your roster, isn't it? Maybe you could tell us a bit about you know, the thrill of seeing audiences react to that this week.
It was really great because I've never even seen the film projected on a big screen, so it was wonderful to be there and see its premiere at the Temple, and then to have Marina there as well to answer questions. So that was exciting, and you know, she just excites really any space and area that she's in. So we're thrilled to be here with her and experiencing it with her.
Sundance is there's obviously a lot of critics rock up, as well as buyers, sellers, PRs, all the rest of it. But in terms of a festival for punters, for your regular cinema goers to buy tickets, and obviously there's queues around the block, lines around the block to see certain things, is that still a mark of the success of the film festival as a whole for documentaries and for features?
Well, I don't know about features, but I know about documentaries. But I do still get the feeling that there are a lot of local people who were not necessarily in the film industry who are at every screening, and I think that really makes it special too, because it's not just an industry thing; it's more of a general public feel to the audiences.
Yeah.
That's certainly what I've felt, at least certainly in the bigger venues, which is nice, which is really important.
And maybe you could give us a little bit of a sort of window into your week at Sundance. I mean, I went last year and made a documentary about what happens at the festival. But what's your sort of life in the day? What's your diary like? Are you kind of buzzing from screening to screening, or is it more of a social event for you, Nancy?
I try and see a lot of screenings. I mean, I do love seeing movies here, and it's such a pleasure to be able to sit in theater and watch a number of documentaries in a day. I mean, I think sometimes I overdo it, and I think you can't do more than four in a day and not start to go a little crazy. So, but I do try and see like three films a day, some of which might be a screening of one of our films, but it's also really important to me to just see as many documentaries as I can. And then on top of that, you have the social stuff as well. It's a great, you know, it's a great experience just being able to see everyone and talk about films, and so you try and squeeze that in, so you don't get a lot of sleep.
Well, that's all right, because there's plenty of fun things to happen in the evening to make you sort of forget about that, I presume. That was Nancy Abraham, Senior VP of Documentaries and Head of Programming at HBO. And what of those famous Sundance parties that make boys of men and nobodies of film stars? We had to go back to Josh Dickey and find out.
There are certainly more parties than you could ever possibly care to go to, and believe me, I've tried. In fact, last night I tried pretty hard. And I think my voice is a couple octaves lower than normal as a result. But it's pretty much wake up, track news, write, talk to sources, and try not to get scooped. And then and then at night, we try to catch a screening, and then it's pretty much parties from there until whenever it is we get home.
Ah, the parties. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now we're off to an independent music retailer to delve into their collection and hear what's been providing some satisfying sounds for their clientele. This week's music recommendations come from CD Studio in Zurich.
I'm Heidi Knecht. I'm the manager of CD Studio in the middle of Zurich behind the Paradeplatz at the Frauminsterstrasse, and I'm running this business for about 28 years now. We opened a store here in Zurich that was more than 28 years ago. It was a huge success because we were the first shop, not only in Zurich, in Europe, who sold CDs. And the first 5-10 years, it was a huge success because it's still a good product. And since then, we're here. Business is running and we're still here. We're a small, specialized store, as you see in the window. We have not the charts in the window. We have the specialized products from jazz, blues, back catalog, also a few of the hits. And we try to sell music, not prices, not discs, music. And we also try to have the intuition to find out what the customer wants. Sometimes people are coming in, they exactly know what I want, but they can't tell you. They only know what they like to hear. And this is the best thing of a job and of our store. We find out what they like. Here, as we are the most expensive place in Zurich, so we have bankers, we have brokers, we have all the things typical for Zurich, but we have many fans of back catalog records like Dylan fans, Stones fans, or lounge specialists. So the clientele is very wide. I choose the music because I see the customer. When I hear something, the representative comes, he presents the new records, I listen to them and I know exactly this could be for him, for this clientele, this is what I like, and when I like it, I can sell it better. So it's a selection, what we like and what we think our clientele could like that too. What we sold very good, for instance, for Mario Biondi, the new one.
Blue skies, while I got me, nothing but blue skies do I see. Yeah. Blue birds singing a song, nothing but blue birds all day long.
Or Etta James.
All of the guys that I have met, you are the one man I can't forget. We had our times now, good and bad times. I can't forget them and I sure ain't gonna regret them, no, no.
Or Adele, of course. What is a chart product, but very good. Idealistic, because it's no more a very good business. But if you like the music and you like the people and you like the clientele, it's just passion, you know. I'm so glad if somebody comes back and says, oh, the last recommendation was just right, I'm so fond of. This is the thing. It's no more making money, to be honest. It's so difficult, but there are the small, charming things in recommendations.
Who'd have thought that Adele would sell well, the lounge music specialist. Anyway, those were some recommendations from the CD studio in Zurich, including the great and late Etta James. Still to come in part two, we'll be hearing why Belgium's two public broadcasters don't talk to each other. We indulge in the golden age of Cambodian cinema, enjoy 60 seconds of Aural Insanity from the Australian Open. Why, oh why, oh why would you want to listen to anything else? Many nations have one public broadcast, but in Belgium there are two. In this small European country of 10 million people, the Flemish-speaking and the French-speaking communities each have their own publicly funded news service. Both work next to each other in the large concrete building called the Reislaan. Outside, journalists smoke together, but once through the front door, they go their separate ways. Reporter Lauren Serulis went there to find out more about the Great Divide.
At the Reislaan in Brussels, a long corridor stretches from the start till end of the building, splitting it in two sides. On the left, the Dutch-speaking VRT. On the right, the French-speaking RTBF. The corridor in the center is referred to as our own language border. The French-speaking RTBF feels like a classic public broadcasting organization. Things haven't changed all too much in the last decades. Cross the border to the VRT and you're suddenly in a more modern space. The VRT built a state-of-the-art newsroom in 2007. So how much do these two sides communicate? Kathleen Kools, anchor of the VRT daily debate program Ter Zake, explains.
It's business as usual at the moment. We don't meet or talk a lot. Mm-hmm. On a regular basis, a few times a year. That's sad to say. It's mainly a cultural difference. It's two worlds we're living in, so it's not by purpose that it happens. We did have a lot of contact the past years, but the main reason was the political crisis.
The crisis that she refers to was an uprising of Flemish nationalism in the north, which caused a deadlock in government negotiations. Politicians on both sides of the country were criticized for failing to listen to each other's opinions. Some say the same about the huge media gap dividing both communities. Dave Sinarde, a political scientist and commentator who speaks regularly on VRT and RTBF, thinks the media situation says a lot about Belgium.
Well, the interesting thing about Belgium is that if you compare with other federal countries, such as Switzerland or Canada, you see that the Dutch-speaking and French-speaking public broadcaster in Belgium are really very autonomous. And that means that the official tasks that the broadcasters get is specifically to aim at their own community, but also to reinforce the culture of the own community, the identity of the own community. And there's actually no reference to the Belgian context, to the federal level. So there is a lot of tendency always to generalize. Another tendency is always to focus on the differences between Flanders and Wallonia. I think it's probably not easy to change this because the logic that you see in the media content is more or less embedded also in the way these media are organized. Two broadcasters do not have any structural ties anymore, but they do still share the same building.
From time to time, things can get quite tense inside that building. In December 2006, the French-speaking RTBF broadcasted a mockumentary called Bye Bye Belgium. It contained a fake news bulletin where it was announced that Flanders had declared its independence.
La Flandre va proclamer unilatéralement son indépendance, vous l'avez compris.
The country was left in shock for a brief moment, before launching into a national debate on the rights and wrongs of this media stunt. Dave Sinarde explains.
Well, what Bye Bye Belgium did do, probably, was create or reinforce the debate on the mutual image that Flemish and French-speaking media gave of the other community. So there is a lot of sensibility now for the image that the media of the other community give about us. But unfortunately, I think there is still not enough sensibility about the question of which image we give of the other community.
This friction did get journalists thinking. Maybe they should reinforce the rare contact they still had, try and close the gap, or cross the corridor more regularly. Joanne Monte is a prominent political journalist at the French-speaking RTBF. She stresses the importance of building bridges with the VRT.
They have a very different analysis of what happens than we have. And that's interesting, to cross the point of views, because otherwise we stay in our own community, and we have no vision of the reality.
One man has even made a living out of this media gap. French-speaking journalist Christophe Debossu hops from side to side, explaining what one community thinks of the other. Debossu started off as a political journalist for RTBF. Now, he has become the only Belgian journalist working for both public broadcasts on a regular basis. He is known in Flanders as well as in Wallonia.
I was one of the, at that time, few journalists who could speak the two languages, so that they tried to ask me to come more and more, for example, to give explanation about the French-speaking point of view. In a certain way, I profited of a lack of bilingual journalist, and also I could use a need of information about the other part. And more than before, we really tried to not being accused to create a gap in the public opinions. We fear to be accused by the other community of being a negative factor in the Belgium cohesion. It's totally changed on that point of view, because there are more and more bridges between the two communities. It's very, very spectacular.
Belgium is a deeply divided nation, often struggling to define itself and searching its soul for some common ground. How to bridge the media gap dividing the communities is at the center of this search. And in the meantime, it is slowly becoming a bit more appreciated to go and say salut, or who is it, across the corridor that separates this nation's two public broadcasters.
And that was Lauren Solis' fascinating report from the Reyerslaan, the divided public broadcast building in Brussels. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24, where we're off to Phnom Penh after this.
Avant-garde.
Avant-garde.
I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much about other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary
to see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's and avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about the things that we live with, the stories behind them, and the industries around them. From the paper clips on your desk, to the furniture in your home, the shops on your doorstep, to the signs that direct you to them.
What Japan offers up in terms of graphic design and architecture, you just cannot miss it. You have to go.
Section D is about craft, design, fashion, architecture, and graphics in all their guises.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, once upon a time in Southeast Asia, there was a small country which, for a brief period, had a vibrant and prolific film industry. Then came along decades of war, which wiped out not only the infrastructure, but many of the stars and filmmakers too. The country was Cambodia, and now a new film is bringing the story of the years when it was Hollywood on the Mekong to a fresh audience, at home and abroad. Golden Slumbers has just been screened in Phnom Penh, where our correspondent Guy Delaunay saw its tale of nostalgia and hope for the future.
The heyday of Cambodian films may have been brief, but while it lasted, it was spectacular. This tiny country produced hundreds of movies in the 1960s and early 70s, the golden years between independence and the genocidal madness of the Khmer Rouge. The decades of war meant almost all the films were lost, but not, it seems, forgotten.
Just the people coming to see the films, Cambodian audience, and they came every day, and kids coming to see a film in the morning, and after they came back in the afternoon, I say, oh, sorry, it's the same film. They say, yeah, we know, but we want to see it again.
Davy Chu is the grandson of Van Chan, one of the most productive filmmakers of the pre-war times. 2 years ago, he became the curator of Cambodian cinema's golden age when he tracked down some of the old films for an exhibition.
It was exactly the same behavior 40 years ago when they told me that, yeah, we would see the same film three times a day without no paying the second and the third ticket. So I was so glad to see this behavior restarted again.
The positive reaction prompted Davy to make a film of his own. Golden Slumbers is a documentary about the movies of the 60s and 70s and the people who created them. It's a tribute that includes extracts from some of the surviving films, and it's received a warm reception at festivals as far afield as Korea and France. But Davy says the acid test was the reaction of the Cambodian audience when they finally saw his film.
It was incredible because they understood everything, because it was a Khmer language, it was also Khmer culture and jokes. So they just applauded all the time, laughed at all the jokes. It was like electric ambience and atmosphere. And at the end, a lot of emotion because the film ends with emotion sequences. And it was a standing ovation for minutes for the four main characters. So it's the actress Disavet and the three living filmmakers that we decided to put in the film, who are Lee Boon Yim, his brother Liu Sering, and Mr. Yvon Ham. So four of them were here in front of the audience, receiving the standing ovation. It was a lot of emotion.
Artists and entertainers suffered terribly under the Khmer Rouge in the late 1970s. Many of the stars and directors died, but some lived to tell their extraordinary tales in Golden Slumbers.
I took some examples from the Indian films. They had songs in their films, so we included songs in our films too.
Yvon Ham was one of the main figures in the Cambodian cinema boom as producer, director, and cameraman.
The success of the films in the 1960s was down to the support we received from the Cambodian audiences. A key factor was that we took many of the stories from popular traditional theatre. Another important thing was that the films featured male and female Cambodian actors, so for the first time, ordinary Cambodians were drawn to the cinemas.
Di Savet was one of the big stars of the era. She started out as a beauty queen before moving into films, where she remembers a heady mix of creativity and danger.
The war was starting in the countryside during 1970 and 1971, but daily life for most Cambodians at that time went on as normal. People could enjoy the nightlife, go to nightclubs. It all seemed normal. My team continued to produce films, but it became very dangerous. One time we went to Kampong Cham province to make a film, and there was a mine on the bridge across the river. Luckily for us, a soldier detonated it before we arrived.
The Khmer Rouge swept into Phnom Penh in 1975. Pol Pot's ultra-Maoists closed the cinemas, theatres and shops and forced the city's 3 million people to march to the countryside. Many didn't survive the journey or the forced labour and summary executions which followed. Di Savet was among the lucky few who escaped abroad, but through death or exile, Cambodian cinema lost many of its brightest stars.
I got information about some film producers who were killed during the Pol Pot regime because people would arrive in Paris from Cambodia and I would listen to their news. I also heard information about my sister and my friends. Pol Pot's army took one famous actress and forced her to sing and act for them. After that, they took her to be re-educated and then killed her.
Yvonne Hem thinks that if it hadn't been for the Pol Pot era, Cambodian cinema might have flourished.
Rich Cambodian families sent their children to learn how to produce films in France, including my family. But when Pol Pot came, everything was gone. And now those people are in business in France. If there hadn't been any Pol Pot, those people who studied there would have come back to develop the film industry in this country.
But now, after spending his childhood in France, Davy Chu has come back, and his efforts go beyond nostalgia for the past. He's working on his own original movies and collaborating with a group of like-minded young Cambodian filmmakers. He thinks Golden Slumbers could provide the spark which reawakens the long-dormant film industry here.
It raised an interest on this old story. I guess also something proud for the audience, because they came to see that, they were happy to see that we focus on a happier period of Cambodia. It's just something meaningful for the people. So I hope that all this energy and all this emotion can be used also toward the present now.
That was Guy Delaunay reporting from Phnom Penh. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Now, 1 minute may not seem like a long time, but in radio, it definitely is. And we love to do our best each week to fill 60 seconds with as many confusing and unexpected noises as we can find, weaving them into a semi-narrative which leaves you, the good listener, either perplexed, entranced, or just downright satisfied. This week, our man in Shanghai, Justin Bergman, popped over to the Australian Open and sent us this.
A lot of line judges in the audience here, Sandra, as you would know. Now they'll go off. Backhand of my back to the front of the table.
If you are leaving, we do hope you have a fantastic day. please stay on the footpath to the right of the entrance.
Love 14.
And he deserves a round of applause himself. That was Justin Bergman's 1 minute of sound from the Australian Open. So we've come again to the end of our culture show. Next week, we'll be laughing our way through the theme of comedy as we visit the London Comedy Film Festival. And we'll also be enjoying some Nordic delights as Jana Factory play a special Midori House session for us. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa and my researcher was Hannah Jenkins. Time for one final song this week from our album of the week, Black Light. This is Diagrams with Night All Night. Thanks for tuning in.
There's a wall in the great divide. Which wire do they cut to blow it? It's a sleepworm inside the skull. Soft mouth on your brainstem. And it dreams about falling dust. Swirl like an old plastic snow globe.